Hi, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Lori Elster, and this is the All Access Star Trek podcast. We're doing something a little different today. Earlier this week, Anthony interviewed Nick Meyer, who do I even need to say who he is, Tony? Do I need to explain this to people?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up.
I think we're good. It was such a great interview, full of so many fascinating nuggets and opinions and news, that we are going to make that the subject of this week's podcast. And you will see some of this stuff is, it's all going to end up on the site, but it's not there yet. So you're actually getting a sneak preview of the interview with Nick Meyer. So we're going to start with the news and then we'll go into the Nick Meyer interview. So let's just cover what's been going on, because there has been some stuff. We got a little bit of Prodigy talk from Kate Mulgrew.
And we still don't know a lot about Kate Mulgrew's character. We know she's,
we know her name,
Janeway.
Yeah.
We believe it's Captain Janeway, because that was mentioned once. And she's now talking a little bit like Patrick Stewart was talking when he came onto Picard, where she took some convincing. She said she was kind of, the phrase she uses, bewildered by the pitch from Alex Kurtzman. And what I'm not sure. I think what she means is, you want me to come back, but you don't want me to come back live. I think that was, I'm not sure she means the concept of the show is bewildering, but what do you think she meant by that?
She said she was slightly bewildered about it being an animated series. So I think maybe she just didn't, is this Voyager? What is this? How does this work? I suspect she has not seen Lower Decks. So I'm guessing she didn't think that it was that, but she clearly had no idea. And then she heard about it and got excited.
And now she says she loves doing the recording and getting back into the character. And
my favorite thing that she said, Star Trek truly is the gift that keeps on giving. And that is a phrase that I hear over and over from all the Star Trek people. I mean, Jonathan Frakes has said it too. It's just one of those things that you do Star Trek, and then for the rest of your life, you get either more work or just appreciation or connection with fans. It's just something that is eternal.
Now, the creators of the show, the Hageman brothers, who are Emmy Award winning animation, kids animation guys, after the images were the one image for Prodigy was released a couple weeks ago, they went out on social media to kind of explain why we haven't seen Janeway yet. Their idea was, once we showed you Janeway, that's all anyone would talk about. So we didn't do that.
True.
We showed you the crew, and I think that makes sense. Yeah. Although you could read into that, because you could imagine what Janeway would look like in that style. So if Janeway was on that list of aliens and she was just like next to them, I'm not sure that's all we would talk about. So I've got my conspiracy hat on, and I think that there's more to it. And this gets back to my theory that Janeway isn't Janeway. She's hologram Janeway.
Right.
Although an image of her might not make that clear, because, you know, the hologram Janeway would probably just look like regular Janeway unless they make her slightly see-through, which I think they might do just to...
different.
Because it's animated.
Right, so just make it clear that it's a hologram.
Yeah. So kind of a translucent Janeway. But there was another good piece of news for the show, which is, so Alex Kurtzman brought these brothers on to create this show for CBS Studios, who produce all of the shows for Paramount Plus, all the Star Trek shows. And they just signed a new deal with CBS Studios this week for a kind of an overall first look deal, where they're going to be doing a live action thing, not necessarily Star Trek, but just... that CBS Studios is now really happy with the work they're doing on Prodigy, as they said in a statement. So they are now have an overall deal with CBS Studios. And that shows you two things. One is that, you know, they like what they're seeing, and it's probably an indication that they may get more than just a 2-season order, which is what they already have. So, you know, it's another vote of confidence. We talked about how David Mack has talked about the show as being the best thing he's ever worked on. And this is kind of another vote of confidence that there's something to this Prodigy thing.
Yeah. And I also think it probably gives them a little more leeway if there are things they want for Prodigy, like let's say someone has a voice talent who is more expensive or something like that, that they definitely have the backing. They're not going to be wrestling and struggling for stuff that they need, I would guess.
Now, you were just talking about Star Trek being the gift that keeps on giving. There was a another Star Trek actor. I mean, we're always interviewing Star Trek actors, and we always ask them, you know, would you come back? Would you work on Picard? Or, and almost all the time they say yes. You know, Michael Dorn said, well, I don't know, but that's only because he wants to do his own TV show. Right. So he definitely, but Colm Meaney, who started on, it was in the pilot for Star Trek The Next Generation, had a recurring role as Chief O'Brien, and then went on to 7 seasons of DS9, was asked that question this week, and he said, no, that was enough. I love Star Trek, but I've had enough. 7 years was enough, and he said, I wouldn't want to ruin a good thing, which I thought was an interesting take.
But then he said, never say never.
Well, I mean, you know, he's an actor, but he definitely has a different point of view, which is interesting. I think that he's not dissing Star Trek. He goes to the conventions. I think he likes Star Trek, but you look at the roles he plays now and the kind of, you know, these kind of more complicated characters he plays. He does a lot of R-rated movies and he plays gangsters. And I think he's just kind of moved on and feels like this would be going backwards. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
No, but, I mean, I think you're right. And he basically is just saying it hasn't been on his mind. Like, he's really moved on and is doing other things and isn't really thinking about it. He's obviously not following, you know, what's going on in Star Trek and thinking, is there a place for me? He's just working on his exciting new roles.
I mean, that being said, taking what I said, and if he was pitched by Patrick Stewart and Alex Kurtzman and they say, we want to bring O'Brien back, but this is going to be a whole new O'Brien. And, you know, now maybe, you know, now he's the head of the Orion crime syndicate. He's this complicated guy and, you know, and he has a dark past and he has an eye patch or whatever, you know, I mean, it's maybe they could, you know, maybe there is a version of O'Brien that they could bring him back into.
Especially if there's an eye patch.
Right. Well, he did have an eye patch in one episode.
I know. Actually, yeah. But no, I do think he would be open to it if it was either a complicated character or just a really fun day. And they were like, oh, we're having a bunch of your old friends. Come on. You know, I feel like people wouldn't say no to that in general.
Yeah.
If it's like an easy shoot or something. And then for sure, I would think Lower Decks, which is an easier one to do.
Right, exactly. I was just going to say, voice work is, I mean, even Michael Dorn, who's kind of, I don't want to put the makeup on again unless it's my TV show, said, oh yeah, well, I'll do voice work, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
So I think anybody will do that because you could do it in your sweatpants. And now you do it from your house.
Yeah, like,
they just send you the equipment.
I was going to say, they just ship you all the stuff and there you go.
Speaking of Picard, kind of, season one showrunner, Michael Chabon, has been releasing little pieces of the mythology he created for the show, for various characters and elements of the show. He did one for Riker and Troy and their time on the Titan. He did one for the Space Vegas, what's that place called? Free Star? Free?
Oh my God.
Free Cloud.
Thank
Free
you.
Cloud.
Yeah.
Free Cloud. And this week he did one all about the Romulans. And it was, I mean, one of the things we talked about this when we did our Picard show, that I liked about Picard was that it did a deep dive into the Romulans. It gave them more depth. We saw that they have different outfits, you know, and, but he took the whole kind of enigmatic thing and he wove that into all elements of their culture. There's stuff about their religion, stuff of, you know,
their homes, their families, like everything's layered and secretive and bonkers.
And it shows you that there's material there for the show to work off of in future seasons. We've already seen elements of this in our interview with James Swallow. He talked about that, about how he used some of the secrecy stuff in his book that came out in January. And I think the, you know, we saw a little bit of this in Discovery because they brought the Coat Malat into Discovery and they were kind of an important part of that ritual. And in his Bible, you know, his thing about Romulans, he talks about how they are an important part of Romulan society. I almost feel like he drew that from Dune, you know. The Bene Gesserit sisters are kind of an important part of Dune society. And I, because you didn't, on the show, they kind of felt like outcasts. But so I'm not sure this came through on the show as the way he envisioned them. Because I think they were more important in Romulan society than we saw them on the show.
Right.
In his original vision of them.
They seemed more important in Discovery's future.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe we'll see elements of that. I mean, we don't know if the Romulans are going to play a big part in season two, but there's stuff for them to work up. Now, a lot of sites, including our own, kind of picked up on the weirdest thing about this, which is he got into Romulan sexuality and Romulan marriages. And apparently every Romulan marriage has three people in it. And so we won't get too into it, but it's worth clicking and reading his whole thing. And I just think it's great that they work all this stuff out, because so often when you ask a writer something, they really didn't do much that more than what you saw on the page, you know. And would you ask them if there's more there? There's like, you know, back when they were making these shows, even guys like Ron Moore and stuff like that, who did so much Klingon mythology, they were cranking out these episodes so fast, they may not have had the time to really build out these kind of big backstories.
Yeah, I can't imagine that they would have with the volume of shows that they had to create. But I think it's incredible that he's posting it, because it's, you know, we all love those very old original series documents where they really did try to at least explain certain things or have a grounding in certain things so everybody could work with the same information, because nobody had heard of the show before. And so when you look at this kind of thing and think about how much time he probably spent thinking about it and mapping it out, because he's a novelist and he thinks very deeply about these things. So it's fantastic to get this level of documentation. However much of it they might choose to use or not in the future, doesn't matter. I still think it's a fascinating little bit of Star Trek production history.
So the last bit of news about the Star Trek Universe shows is that this week is kind of the last week of award season nomination announcements. And we saw a few more in the last couple weeks for various Star Trek shows. Picard got a makeup one. Discovery got a visual effects one. There was a whole bunch of costume guild nominations for Discovery. And then Lower Decks got one nomination for the Annie Awards, which are the animation awards, which is kind of new for Star Trek because, you know, animation hasn't been around for a while for Star Trek. And the one nomination they got was for music. So it was nothing for acting, writing, all of the production stuff. I feel like this is a little bit of a snub from the Annie Awards. And, you know, when you look at the rest, you know, there was no PG, you know, for the rest of the Star Trek universe, they went out and did all those interviews, and there's nothing from the producers, the directors, the Actors Guild, the Writers Guild, the Editors Guild, the Cinematographers Guild. And in every one of those cases, I believe the Mandalorian got a nomination.
Aww.
And some, you know, so it's not just sci-fi. Star Trek is still, you know, it did okay, you know, relative to other years. There was also some Image Awards and GLAAD Award nominations this year, and Saturn Awards. I got 7 Saturn Award nominations in the last week, which is a pretty good showing. So those were for both Picard and for Discovery.
Yeah, in some cases, I think in one, they're at least up against each other, right? They're both nominated for Best Sci-Fi TV Series.
So there's a little head-to-head competition there.
No, and then the most interesting one is that Jeri Ryan is up for Best Guest Starring Performance on Television for Picard, but one of her competitors is Kate Mulgrew for Mr. Mercedes.
There's a lot of documentary news.
There is.
Believe it or not. So we're in a golden age of Star Trek documentaries. There's a brand new documentary series, an 8-part documentary series called The Center Seat, that was just announced, and it's going to be on the History Channel. It's very exciting.
It's funny because when we were talking about Paramount Plus, we were talking about how they should be doing documentaries on the current shows and the franchise itself, the whole franchise. So it looks like someone was thinking the same way. It's that, you know, Brian Volk-Weiss, who is he the EP? Hmm. Is he, it's his company?
Well, he it's the Nacelle company, right, which shows you how much of a Star Trek nerd he is. Both you and I have interviewed him in the past. I interviewed him for The Toys That Made Us. You interviewed him for another Star Trek documentary he made
for the 50th anniversary. It was for the 50th anniversary. And it was also on the History Channel. It was called 50 Years of Star Trek, and it had the last interview ever done with Leonard Nimoy.
He's going to be directing it. He created it, and the showrunner for it is the guy who has run the shows for The Toys That Made Us and The Movies That Made Us, which are both great docuseries on Netflix. And the executive producer list includes our friend Mark Altman, who, you know, is the expert in all things Star Trek. He's literally written the book on Star Trek and, or co-written, and he does the Inglorious Trekspert's podcast. And Gates McFadden is an executive producer.
I'm fascinated by that.
Well, I think that's because the Nacelles company recently announced a new podcast series that featuring her.
Yeah, I remember that.
Even though this is going to cover all 55 years, I suspect, especially with Mark Altman involved, it's going to lean heavily into the original series and the Next Generation. But it's supposed to cover everything. I mean, they said they're going to cover Phase 2, not the fan series, but the series that never happened, and the animated series. So they are going to cover every element of Star Trek. They're claiming it is going to be the ultimate Star Trek documentary, the final word until the 60th anniversary of everything you wanted about Star Trek. So it's going to be 8 parts, and then there's going to be a 2-hour post series after show kind of thing as well, which we're still trying to get details on. So it's all very exciting. So we're, looking forward to this. It's probably going to come out in September.
Well, that would be the anniversary. It's funny, when I interviewed him a couple of years ago for the first one, he said the one thing that he wished he could have done was do a whole section just about Lucille Ball. And he said, you know, she doesn't get the credit she deserves. I mean, I see people talking about it, but I understand what he means. And he says she invented the rerun, which is also interesting. So I think he gets to do it now, because that's one of the things they talked about, was starting way back when.
In other documentary news, we've already talked about the Voyager documentary launching. They've, in 1 week, they just blew through all these records. They're now the highest funded documentary on Indiegogo ever. You know, previously the DS9 doc, and then they only did that in like 8 days. I think they're up to like 700,000. They've blown through all their stretch goals. I think now they're kind of coming up with these kind of weird stretch goals. The latest one was, you know, get your face on a poster.
Like a mosaic. It's getting a little weird. Yeah.
So there's a lot of cool stretch goals. Like, it's going to be bigger, longer, you know, better. The one stretch goal, which they haven't announced, and now it's getting weird why they won't officially announce it, is remastering clips of Voyager in HD like they did with DS9. They keep on hinting at it, but they haven't said it. Supposedly it's something to do with getting CBS to finally say yes. So we expect that's coming. There's still weeks to go, but the Voyager documentary is shaping up. And as we talked about this last week, we're a little worried about scope creep. But I'm still very excited about it, and it's heartening to see fans just really support it in a big way.
Agreed.
One last bit of news, it's just a fun thing. 4 years ago, William Shatner shot this movie with his Star Trek 3 co-star, you know, adversary.
Nemesis,
dare Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Except now they're playing best friends. Shatner plays an astronaut. It's called Senior Moment. So it's kind of a movie making. It's a comedy where he plays this kind of, senior citizen who loses his license and has to start taking the bus. And he falls in love with
Jean Smart.
Yeah.
I'm actually very excited about him and Jean Smart because I've loved her ever since 24. She just blew my mind on that show.
Yeah, he shot it 4 years ago and then we never heard it. But now they're looking for a distribution deal. They're releasing trailers. So now it looks like it's finally going to happen. And so be looking for that sometime in 2021 on video on demand, I suspect.
He's turning 90 this month.
Yeah, isn't that exciting?
I am excited.
It's amazing. So he's celebrating his 90th birthday in a kind of cool way where he's going back to Star Trek the Tour in Ticonderoga, which is the original set tour. Yeah, but they're calling it a birthday celebration, and you could hang out with William Shatner on the replicas of these sets. These are the ones used for, if you remember, the Phase 2 Star Trek New Voyages fan films. Tickets are like $50, but you could buy this, you know, $1,200 package.
Oh, that's,
you get to have dinner with Shatner.
$1,500, baby.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. Neither of us are paying for. Neither of us are going to pony up that kind of cash. But regardless, I'm sure there are a lot of fans who would be very excited to get a personal tour from Shatner, get to hang out on the bridge with him, and, you know, have dinner with him and all the cool stuff that'll go along with it. So that's enough news for the week, except that we have some other news which came out of my interview with Nicholas Meyer.
Yeah, there was some good stuff in there, but also some things we'd never heard anywhere else.
The whole purpose of this interview was he's releasing 11 years later the audiobook for his memoir, A View from the Bridge, which he wrote 11 years ago, and now they're doing an audiobook. So it's not the first time I've interviewed him. I think I've interviewed him at least half a dozen times. I've moderated a couple panels with him in person. So he and I have a bit of a rapport, but it's always a Nick Meyer interview is always challenging because he doesn't suffer fools and he's very erudite and you just have to pay attention and it's almost like a game show, you know, where I'm constantly feeling like I'm doing some, you know, going to get something wrong because he will correct you.
Yeah. I was going to ask you if it's like, you've done so many of these interviews and you're calm for all of them, but I was wondering if this one made you a little bit nervous.
No more nervous. Well, a little bit at the beginning, because for some reason he wanted to do it on Zoom, because we've always done them over the phone. But in the new Zoom era, he's gotten into the whole Zoom thing. And I do Zoom a lot, but I often am, you know, I have two screens. So I'm looking at one screen and then there's the monitor. And at the beginning, I was looking at my notes and my questions, and I could tell he was getting annoyed that I wasn't looking directly at him for a moment. So I had to kind of turn off the view of me and look straight at him to make sure. And that kind of changed the tone of it so that he knew I was fully engaged in him, and everything went fine for the most part after that. Except that he never really answers questions you ask
him. Everything you ask him would give him like a good reason to launch into a philosophical view of something versus specifically answering the question. And yet I find all his answers pretty interesting, even if they don't get specifically to the heart of what you were trying to find out.
Right. You may ask him about a tree and he doesn't want to talk about the tree or the forest. He wants to talk about, you know, the history of logging.
Right.
Or
the rainfall.
Yeah, exactly.
And his philosophy of how they all work together. So you still get something interesting. You just don't quite get what you were after.
But there was some news. So let's start with that. Just like I've asked other people, like when I talked to Ron Moore a few weeks ago, we're in this kind of period where we don't know what's next for the movie series. Last week, that was our kind of focus discussion, and we just had that breaking news where Kalinda Vasquez was tapped by Paramount to write a script, which is the latest script since 2016 that has been commissioned. This one could have some momentum. But, you know, I was like, what would you do? You know, especially people who were involved in successful movies. So I asked him, you know, that. But what I wasn't ready for is, you know, this, he wasn't talking, going to talk philosophically or in theory about it. He's like, he had something, you know, and I wasn't ready for this, you know. I'm like, wait, what? You know, so what he surprised me on is that he actually has an idea and he's pitched it. And he revealed that he pitched this to Paramount with Stephen Charles Jaffe, who he worked with on Time After Time and Star Trek VI and some other projects. And so let's play a clip where he kind of explains what happened. So you two wrote a script.
We didn't write a whole script. We wrote a very detailed treatment and a whole, you know, pitch doc with illustrations, and it's a very comprehensive thing. And first we took it to Alex Kurtzman, then we took it to JJ, then I think we took it to Emma Watts at Paramount. And we've never heard from anybody.
Now, was this done cold, or did they kind of say, yeah,
no, this was us.
Okay. So you have an idea, but...
Well, it's more than an idea.
What would you call it? What can you say about it?
Well, I don't want to say a lot about it. All I can say, it was a detailed proposal for what could have been a film, or it could have been a series, or it could have been a film leading to a series, or a series leading to a film.
Or a series of films?
Could be a series of films. Yeah, absolutely.
So you must have been shocked when he said that.
Well, you can hear it in my voice. I was, you know, usually I try to keep a calm tone, but I was like, wait, what's going on here? Because I was ready for him to go back into his philosophical, you know, talk about the history of Paramount Pictures going back to 1927. I was not ready for him to say, oh, yeah, I just did this. You know, this is happening.
I know. I could picture you like writing the article while he was talking.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, boy, here it comes. So that was exciting and interesting. I think reading between the lines and based on what happened last week, I'm not sure that Paramount is chomping at the bit for this idea.
Well, he said he never heard from anybody, so that's a pretty good guess.
But they took the meeting. I mean, he had a meeting with Kurtzman, which, you know, is good, right? And then he had a meeting with J.J. Abrams.
And he's friends with both of those guys.
Right. Yeah. You know, he's known J. He went to JJ's bar mitzvah, you know, so they're family friends going way back. Emma Watts took a meeting, and she doesn't know him from anything, but she's obviously taking meetings, hearing people give pitches. It's a courtesy to him as someone who's been part of the franchise, but she's been said to be someone kind of looking for ideas, and I think this was many months ago.
But she's also not going to waste her time if she's not going to just humor someone. She's busy. So I assume that she thought, okay, well, this is someone worth hearing from for sure.
So she's got another treatment on her desk. I suspect he's not the only person who's gone in to pitch something in the last year to Paramount.
Yeah.
You know, we hear about projects when they have, you know, when they commission a script, and that, you know, they're paying for that. So we had the script from Tarantino. Now there's this one from Kalinda. There was the one with Chris Hemsworth and, you know, the Noah Hawley script. Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't cost them anything to hear someone pitch to them.
No, just time.
So.
Yeah. No. And it sounds like in this case, they came up with a very sort of thorough idea, because he says it could have been a series, it could have been a film series, it could have been all kinds of things. So obviously they developed, it sounds like they just developed this, they came up with it on their own and thought this would be a cool thing.
So once we got through kind of the logistics that, yeah, there was a pitch, what's the status of the pitch? Obviously, I want to know everything about the pitch. I want to know who's in it. And so he did actually reveal a little bit. So let's hear what he had to say about what the story was of this pitch. The big thing with Star Trek is you've got, you know, the Shatner movies, you got the movies with the TNG crew, then you have the JJ movies. They're all kind of three blocks of movies. Would this tie into any of those three blocks or be something totally separate?
This was an independent piece of the Star Trek universe based on holes in the chronology, which would allow for the insertion of original material.
New characters.
You bet.
New characters. New cast. So you would be not recasting, but casting from scratch, essentially.
Correct.
So holes in the chronology is interesting. I immediately thought of a very obvious one, which is the time between original series and Next Generation. I know you had another one that you considered also.
That's why I asked if this was tied into anything he's done before, because I thought the last time he looked at a hole in the chronology was his SETI Alpha 5 miniseries idea, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, which is between the original series and Star Trek II. So I thought, well, maybe he still wants to play around in that area, even though this is a different idea, obviously, because it's new characters, so it wouldn't be Khan and it wouldn't be Kirk, but it would be, you know. But those are the two obvious holes in the Star Trek universe that I think he might be drawn to as someone who worked in the movie era.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
Because, you know, the hole after TOS would essentially be a sequel to Star Trek VI, if you think about it that way, because he wrote the last original series movie.
Although he's talking about all new characters, everything new. So you can, I mean, maybe officially a sequel, but not really. It's not that he necessarily would want to pick up on those events. We don't know. I mean, we're just guessing. So,
right. Sequel meaning in the timeline after, but not tied, but not sequel in tied to that movie at all.
Right.
Because it would be new characters and a, you know, as he described it, you know, original material. So independent. Whatever that means. But I don't suspect, this is kind of important. This doesn't sound like it would have anything to do with the Kelvin movies either.
No.
So this would be probably Prime Universe. So I think that is kind of important. So even though he's not telling us what it is, he's saying it fills a hole, I assume that means in the Prime Universe.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I would assume that too. It's an interesting idea. It's certainly an interesting time. Like, I think the time between, to me, the most interesting time is between original series and Next Generation. Because there was so much evolution in there. There's a lot of change. And change doesn't usually come that easy. And you could, it could definitely explore some ideas that could use a closer examination.
We talked about this last week of, can you do a Star Trek movie? Is the Star Trek universe enough of a draw? So you've got some spaceships, they've got some nacelles on them, you've got people in colorful outfits with phasers. So that all says to a general audience, Star Trek. And there's probably a Vulcan involved, you know, because, you know, so if you have enough familiar Star Trek elements, but no Star Trek characters, so there's no Picard or Sisko or Kirk or Khan or anyone we've heard of, is that enough for a feature film, especially if Paramount wants a tentpole, hundreds of million dollar grossing feature film? Is it enough just to be in the Star Trek universe without any familiar characters, even though they might hire some familiar actors, you know, who haven't been part of Star Trek?
I mean, in a way, it makes it easier. You know, their dilemma is always how to attract the non-Star Trek fans. Because, yes, there are a lot of Star Trek fans, and they kind of know that they're coming no matter what. So then they want to attract all these other people. And that might be a way into it, because those other people don't feel like they have to come with any knowledge or baggage.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, that this is just, it's new to everybody.
Right.
But for whatever reason, we don't know Emma Watts's thinking of, does she lean more to want familiar characters, especially familiar characters who've been played by familiar actors, or does she want something entirely new?
She might also want a different point of view, because Nick Meyer's an old school guy.
Right. And we know that he's not writing a movie full of exciting space explosions. And I'm not saying that, you know, Kalinda is doing that either, but she did work on Discovery and she knows the game. And we know that that's not Nick Meyer's shtick.
Right. He doesn't even, He doesn't even tend to do, I mean, the Star Trek movies he's done don't really involve super exotic aliens. Right?
Right.
So,
but there was some exciting action. I mean, let's face it, there was some cool action in Star Trek VI. And of course, there's, you know, the most famous Star Trek battle is in Star Trek II.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although it's done in a very different way that you probably wouldn't see in a modern feature film, because it's kind of that old Napoleonic War style of space battle where, you know, it's almost or more of a submarine movie, which is something in my interview with him, he kind of was drawn to the kind of submarine aspect of Star Trek, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But the question is, does Paramount think that's right. great?
Right. I mean, they might not be thinking that way. They're looking at things from a different perspective. But
even though in the end, he really cares about character.
I agree. And I think that the Star Trek movies from him that we've seen are beautiful explorations of character. I mean, and Khan, I mean, I know Khan existed before Star Trek II, but he's the best Star Trek movie villain that we've ever had by a long shot.
And you didn't need to have seen the Space Seed.
No, you didn't. And you just had to understand that there was a vendetta. But I feel like the thing that I really liked about Khan in that movie is that there are moments when you're not rooting for, like, you don't want him to defeat Kirk, but you're disappointed for him. You know, you have these moments where you want him. He's worked so hard and fought so hard from where he was to where he is. And you have this moment of like, oh, you almost want it to happen for him because you truly understand him as a villain, as a person. There's a depth there.
Right, which is the whole goal of writing a good villain, is that you can sympathize with them because the villain thinks he's the hero of his own story.
Right, and as much as I enjoyed Star Trek Beyond, I think that was the big weakness, was that their explanation of what the villain's issues were didn't really connect or make any sense, and you didn't really understand why he was doing the things that he was doing.
Ask your average person the name of the villain in all the Star Trek movies that have had villains, right? So, you know, you and I could probably do it, but it's how many of them have been memorable, really?
Yeah, there's the Borg Queen and Khan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's basically it. You know, people might remember the actor, but they won't remember the character's name or really anything about them.
Yeah.
But you kind of got what the Borg Queen was after. You got what Khan was after. And as Ron Moore said a few weeks ago, when he's like, when you're writing a Star Trek movie, you know, the cliche is, okay, who's going to be the Khan and what is his vendetta? It's like, it's become a formula. And I would assume Nick Meyer, though, isn't, you know, using that formula, because he doesn't like to repeat himself.
No.
So,
but he does like to dig into character, and that is what I like best about his work.
So this was all very exciting news. I would say I wouldn't expect this to move to the top of the list at Paramount. I'm glad they took the meeting, and for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but you know, I kind of hope maybe elements of this could be used in something else. And of course, he talked about how there could be a TV aspect of this, and you know, maybe this is a Paramount Plus smaller Star Trek movie a few years from now, or a miniseries if they ever do miniseries. And in fact, that brings us to our next topic, which is the SETI Alpha miniseries idea that he pitched back when he was working on Discovery. So, you know, hopefully all of our listeners remember this, but Brian Fuller, one of his first hires was to bring Nicholas Meyer in as a writer and producer for Star Trek Discovery back in, I guess, 2016, you know, somewhere around then, mm-hmm. right? And I talked to Nick briefly about that. He was a consulting producer on the show. He didn't have any writing credits on the show, even though we know that he did write at least one of the versions of the pilot or co-wrote at one point. So he really didn't want to talk much about his time on Discovery.
No.
So we, you know, that's kind of not a major part of the interview, but I did get into him about the SETI Alpha 5 project.
Well, I think that the thing that you wanted to basically ask him is that still going or is it dormant? What's happened?
Exactly. He first mentioned it to me. We broke the news that this thing even existed years ago before we even knew what it was. He only mentioned in one interview I did with him, this is the last time he pulled one of these. Oh, yeah. He's like, I'm working on another Star Trek project. And I'm like, what? <It's> like, so he just likes to drop these little bombs in the middle of interviews. You know, so we've heard a little bit about this in the last few years, but just a couple weeks ago, Paramount Plus did a whole big thing and they talked about their 5 shows. And, you know, they're still not talking about this Khan miniseries.
No, it's never on the list. When they go through it, it's not there.
So I asked him if it was dormant. Let's hear what he had to say about that idea.
Well, I don't consider it dormant because I think it's a terrific project. I think what happened was that the business model for streaming was changing really fast. And what was originally commissioned as a 3-hour or 3-night event, by the time I finished writing it, 3 hours was not enough. They wanted, you know, longer stuff. And somewhere between those two imperatives, the thing got sort of, you know, like fell between two stools. And I still don't know why they're not doing it. And, you know, even if it's to say, give us 10 episodes instead of 3 or whatever, I don't know why. I don't have a straight answer.
For your vision of the show, do you think it could be a 10 episode or an ongoing series, or do you just see it as this kind of miniseries type idea?
Well, that may be a defect of imagination on my part. I think if it went on and on and on about Khan and CD Alpha 5, it risks becoming a kind of Gilligan's Island, which I think is the wrong idea. But as I say, the whole idea of it was Alex's idea. He came to me and said, what do you think about this? And I was over the moon about it. I just thought it was such a great idea and couldn't wait to do it.
That is fascinating that it was Alex's idea. Alex Kurtzman came up with it. That was something he was even interested in and then came to the Khan expert to create something.
Well, way back in the early days, back in 2016 to 2018, we heard both Alex and CBS Studios and executives talk about this idea of doing limited series for Star Trek. And I think that's a great idea. And obviously Nicholas Meyer thinks it's a great idea. Alex used to think it's a great idea, but now what he's saying is the reason that this isn't happening, or at least one of the reasons, is they've kind of moved away from this idea of doing limited series.
Right. I mean, I think ultimately Picard is something of a limited series that I don't think they're planning on going farther than 3 seasons. But,
well, that's 30 episodes.
Right. No, I was going to say this was, you know, something that Nick said to you in the interview is that it was initially commissioned as a 3-hour thing. So they were thinking of very limited.
Right. And, you know, his joke about it becoming like Gilligan's Island, like that there's no, you can't squeeze more out of this thing. And so he doesn't sound like he'd be interested in turning it into a series. But I 3 hours may be too small of, because if you think about how hard it would be to make something like this, it would involve a lot of location shooting, obviously, and it'd be expensive. And for a TV show, you want to spread those costs out as much as you can. You know, they wouldn't be able to use any of the other sets. So, it would be an expensive production, but I still think that they shouldn't limit themselves to just doing ongoing series. I would like, you know, the new Kenobi series is going to be a limited series at Disney Plus. I think some of the other Star Wars series they've announced are more limited series. So maybe 3 is too short, but a 6 episode you know, 8-episode, 10-episode, 1-season series. I mean, the CBS All Access, sorry, Paramount Plus just did The Stand, right? I guess it was CBS All Access when it was The Stand. And that was 6 episodes, 8 episodes, something like that.
I gotta admit, I stopped watching.
Okay, well... But it, you know, but
no,
it,
look, the miniseries was a big, when I was a kid, miniseries was a big deal. There were huge tentpole miniseries that were on the air. And so I think there is definitely room for that. I don't know how much you could sustain if it was really Khan and his people in SETI Alpha 5. I don't know how much, I mean, you'd have to weave in something else, I think, to keep people's interest.
Yeah, you have to keep them on the planet for the, I would assume. And
I mean, judging by what little we've seen of their, you know, what they were living through, you wouldn't need expensive sets for that. So,
well, I believe this is SETI Alpha 5 before SETI Alpha 6 exploded, right? So it's, you know,
they've built
it
some
really
stuff.
Was
yeah.
It really was the garden spot. It's not just, you know, a windswept desert. It's funny because he sounds like he's still excited about it. He hasn't given up on the idea, but I guess, you know, because we're still not hearing. We're hearing about them thinking about the next series. They've got their 5 series they're doing now, and they're not going to do another one until one of those kind of ends. So, but I still think that they should consider miniseries, maybe even mini movies for Star Trek. And, you know, I haven't read the script for this thing, but I think they'd get a lot of buzz for a Khan, Noonien and Singh prequel helmed by the guy who wrote Wrath of Khan. I mean, I think that would sell well. It would be easy to sell to the mainstream media.
Plus you'd get
a lot of buzz.
A big story as you were casting the lead, for sure. You could get a lot of buzz about who that person's going to be.
So here's the question. Do you cast an Indian actor or a Latino actor? Which is more, how are you honoring Star Trek better?
Well, I guess the question is, are you honoring Khan or are you honoring Ricardo Montalban? Is the question.
Yeah. I don't know what the right answer is. I would think, to be perfectly honest, I think they would cast a Indian actor.
So do I. And then maybe we'd get to see Marla, who we never got to see in Wrath of Khan because she was dead.
Right. I believe there was a version where she, of the script where she was, where she died. So we did see her. I don't know. I mean, there's so many versions of that script that, you know, there's something in all of them. But go on.
I just was thinking it would be interesting to see how someone from Starfleet, who was a little sort of not so grounded in reality because she's in her quarters painting pictures of historical figures and things like that, how she would deal with that scenario. And she's with all these people that aren't what she's used to. I don't know. It could have been an interesting aspect of the story to explore.
There's another quirky element of this, which is that all of the genetic supermen come, you know, from a period that never happened, right? So the eugenics wars were supposed to happen in the 90s, right? And I know that there, you know, there's a series of books that tries to weave the eugenics wars into real history, but unfortunately real history violates Star Trek canon, where we never saw the eugenics wars, we never saw the launch of the Botany Bay. So because all of these characters, I think they could have played around with canon a little bit and made all of these characters from the 2020s. And they could have created a new version of the eugenics wars that happened in the 21st century. So they could have almost been our contemporaries, right? They could have been characters that talked about the 21st century and who now find themselves, because they basically were woken up and then put into exile. So we never really, you know, so we'd learn more about all of these characters and they'd be a fish out of water, stranded on this planet.
Or are they really fish out of water if they're by themselves and there's nobody else there?
We assume that people stop by. there's you know, maybe there's some natives on the planet. Maybe there's, you know, Klingons come by for coffee. Mm. It wouldn't be fun if it was just the internal politics of these various genetic supermen.
15 people or whatever, however many people there are.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be an outside element.
That's the idea of having a show, miniseries.
But I think that's why he kind of brought up Gilligan's Island. There's a limit to how many weird things can drop by this island,
right,
where they're stranded. Right.
A ship shows up. Do they get out? No. Again. Yeah.
So there's that. So for everyone who wanted to know about what's going on with the Khan miniseries, now you know. And you're the first to know.
Yes. All right. So what else? I mean, he talked about so many fascinating things, past and present. What else really popped for you?
Well, something I was curious about is, you know, he worked on Star Trek VI, and at that point he had done three movies, which people thought was the good ones, right? You know, the joke is that the even numbered ones, even though I, you know, I love them all, but
yeah,
certainly Paramount saw them as the good ones. And I was curious, did he have any involvement with Star Trek between the end of Star Trek VI and when he started working on Discovery, which is about a 25-year gap. And so let's hear what he had to say about that.
Were you ever informally involved with Star Trek? Were there any times you reached out, they reached out, a director or writer consulted with you, that kind of thing, during the 90s, the 2000s, and maybe during the J.J. Trek era?
Not that I recall. I was on the Paramount lot when J.J. was filming something, and I've known J.J. since I used to read him bedtime stories. And I met the guys who were writing the screenplay for that movie. I can't remember which one it was, but they were really enthusiastic and so pleased to, you know, say hi. And but that, I don't recall any other interactions.
And not in the 90s when Rick Berman was in charge.
Rick Berman was not interested in my, he's a very nice person, but for whatever reason, had no use for me.
I'm just picturing him reading bedtime stories to J.J. Abrams. I got a little caught up in that. But then the Rick Berman part is, it's interesting that Rick didn't want to talk to him, didn't see him as someone worth taking meetings with or listening to.
Basically, Rick was taking the television model, which is the executive producer is the guy in charge, and applying it to the movies.
Right.
Right. So all the directors he hired were essentially working for him. Whereas, you know, usually with the movies, the director has a lot more power, a lot more say. And so he probably didn't want to bring anyone like that in. No, no offense to David Carson and to Jonathan Frakes, but I could kind of see how Rick was running things, and the idea of him and Nick Meyer working together doesn't fit.
Right, and he also clearly had a very clear vision in his own head of what Star Trek is. I mean, it was at a time of all these shows running, and he was really controlling all of that. And to him, this was Star Trek, and he probably wasn't tremendously open to some really different approach at that time.
In addition to kind of talking to his time after Star Trek VI, in the full interview, and there's a lot more, but I want to highlight a couple moments of talking about the movies he worked on. We had gotten into a talk about deleted scenes, and he really didn't want to get into how he chose deleted scenes, because I wanted to talk to him about the Savick, being a Romulan thing. And he didn't want to get into those specifics, but he started talking about the notion of director's cuts, which he's not exactly a huge fan of, believe it or not. So, and so then I asked him, because when they released Star Trek II on DVD, that was promoted as the director's edition. So I wanted to talk to him about how he sees the difference between a director's cut and director's edition. So let's hear what he had to say about that.
When they re-released Star Trek II, didn't they call it a director's edition? Wasn't there a version of it called a director's edition?
They may have called it a director's edition, because I wouldn't let them call it the director's cut.
Because of the scene at the end, which you didn't even shoot, right?
Well, it wasn't that. That scene was always in the movie. It was in it over my objections from the beginning. But, you know, rightly or wrongly, this is the movie business. That's how it worked. I lost a couple of smaller battles with Paramount about stuff, you know, where they felt bound to lift a leg and pee on it a little bit, just to whatever. And once the movie was released and we were doing the television version, they basically said, well, we don't care. What, you know, what is it that you feel so strongly about? And what I felt strongly about was that the midshipman who gets killed is Scotty's nephew. Otherwise, I don't understand why he's so freaked out over the death of one particular,
right?
You know, and so forth. And just little tiny tweaks that you couldn't seriously call this, in my opinion, the director's cut. It was a little ridiculous.
I could not agree more about Scotty's nephew. I think it's really important that he's Scotty's nephew.
Yeah. It's a weird cut. I can get why they didn't include the Savick as a Romulan, because it's kind of a little inside baseball. But this is a character moment that anyone can get, and it's so important. So,
yeah. Right. I mean, it wasn't just, oh, he's a young kid and something happened, but there's a reason that he's singled out. And Scotty's so grief-stricken. It's such a big moment for him, and it certainly takes away from it if the audience is looking at that and thinking, okay, well, there's some other dead people too.
I did try to ask him. There's something that was going around on the web recently. Was people were pointing out that they think they see skulls in the Genesis Cave. And I've asked him about the Genesis Cave sequence in the past. That's kind of one thing he's said he might even consider having them do a new digital version of that, even though he's like very much against people redoing old movies. He's definitely not George Lucas like in any way. But that was one exception. But when I wanted to ask about the specifics of that, he just went off on how art is, you know, basically it's up to the viewer to decide what they see. So we'll never hear Nick Meyer explain whether there really were hidden skulls in the Genesis Cave.
But it's an interesting conversation to have. I feel like I've said the word interesting 75 times in this podcast, so I just would like to apologize. But I think it's a worthy discussion, because we do, you know, art is very much how you take it and what you interpret from it and what you get out of it. And that's what matters. But there also is a very literal question. If you're talking about a movie and you're asking if something was created on the set, either it was or it wasn't. So I think even though he's saying it doesn't matter if it was or it wasn't, I still want to know if it was or it wasn't. It might.
Well, if there were, you know, skulls there, then that means that there was life on this lifeless asteroid, which means Starfleet wiped out. You know, they committed genocide. It's kind of dark.
Yeah.
You know, if there were some animals or stuff, so it would be kind of important. But I guess that's left for us to decide whether Starfleet accidentally, and Carol Marcus a murderer? We don't know. You know, or did she put them in, you know, or were they just part of the kind of design that she was going
for?
She
thought it was cool.
Fake skulls.
She could have just thought it was cool.
I don't think they're real, by the way. I think that people are seeing skulls and they're not meant to be there. I guess, well, someday, you know, we'll have to ask some of the set dressers and the people,
right,
who, you know.
But I think we just proved his point.
The miniature creators.
We just proved his point in some way, too. Because we are saying it is your interpretation. And you're going to see Carol Marcus perhaps in a different light if you decide that those skulls really mean something.
Right.
All right, Nick, you win this one.
I also followed up with something, you know, in my recent interview with Ron Moore. He was pointing out how Star Trek movies need spectacle and you need fighting and all that kind of action stuff. But Ron kind of pointed out how, except for Star Trek IV, is kind of this exception. And so I asked Nick whether, as he was crafting the script for Star Trek IV, there was any pushback that from Paramount to say, you know what, we need some more explosions and, you know, we need them to the Enterprise to fight some Klingons, you know.
Right. Where are the bad guys? Yeah.
Yeah. He basically said no, but he did reveal there was a, you know, there was at least one thing that he got some pushback from Paramount on for Star Trek IV. So let's hear what he had to say about that.
The only argument I ever had with my friend Dawn Steele, who's no longer alive, tragically, she was running Paramount. And the big argument that we had, and it was hilarious, was she kept wanting to know what the probe was asking.
Right.
And I kept saying, the gas will go out of the balloon if you find out what the probe is asking. It's, you know, she's very literal minded about this. And, you know, we had a lot of screaming phone conversations, sort of laughing at the same time. And she was saying, you know, you're wrong, Nikki Meyer. And, but that's the only time that she ever, and that was before we ever rolled. And once we rolled, it was very smooth, actually, that film.
I cannot stop picturing the screaming argument about the whale probe. I mean, Dawn Steele was a huge figure at the time heading up Paramount. She was legendary. And the two of them on the phone screaming about what was the probe saying? What was the probe saying? Again, I'm going to agree with him.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it was a mystery. It was enigmatic. It was a giant space ho-ho. Who knows what is going on? You know, they were trying to get in touch with the Hostess Company, which no longer existed. That's my headcanon. I don't know. You know, it's much better to not know, I think, in this case.
Plus, then we can make a movie from the perspective of the whales and tell the same story.
Yeah. But I do find it interesting that they weren't pushing them to have, you know, what they probably would do today, which is, you know, we need a bad guy. We need some fight scenes. We need some phaser fights and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of come to be expected in all aspects of Star Trek.
And yet Star Trek IV is very Star Trek and completely entertaining in every way. Yeah. And certainly appealed to a much wider audience, I would think.
Yeah, it was funny. It the fish out of water stuff was great. I love Star Trek IV, and certainly I think it's a great piece of 1980s cinema.
But even watching it now, I think it still holds up. The dialogue is still very funny, and the story is still very relevant.
It's a great environmental story.
Right. I mean, I'd always wanted to know what happened to Dr. Gillian Taylor after all that. Talk about fish out of water, because they reversed it and she got to stay. But it was a terrific movie and didn't need any of that other stuff.
I believe Star Trek literature, the, you know, non-canon Star Trek fiction, there was the book Probe that kind of got more into the whale probe. And there, I believe, Gillian Taylor ended up in a book or two. So if you're really searching for these answers, they're probably out there in some form or
other. So maybe someone who's read them can come to our site and tell me. I've got a lot going on right now. All right. So the rest of the Nick Meyer interview, it will eventually all be up on our site for you to read it in all its glory. But those are some great highlights. And Tony, good job on that interview. That was fascinating.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll talk to him again and get even more surprises of things that he hasn't told us yet.
I feel like you will. Seems like a good bet.
So let's move on to our weekly feature, our Star Trek Bits of the Week. And I'll start off. First, I've got a follow-up. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned at NASA, the Perseverance rover landed, and the person who was doing the play-by-play for NASA, Dr. Mohan, was my Star Trek fan of the week because it was revealed that she was inspired by Star Trek, and that got her to eventually get a doctorate from MIT and work for NASA. So last week, President Biden called in to NASA to congratulate the team, And she started talking to President Biden about Star Trek, which I thought was really cool.
What did she say?
Just kind of the same thing of how she was inspired by Star Trek and it led her to, you know, get involved with space science. And
was he responsive to that? I mean, Obama's the Star Trek fan. So
there was no recognition. It would have been cool if he said something about Captain Kirk, but I think it just kind of washed over right. him. Obama would definitely have been a better person to talk to about that. But I just think, you know, it's funny. It's cool that, you know, there you could get the clip on C-SPAN and you go to whitehouse.gov and read the transcript. And there it is. She's talking about Star Trek. Anyway, my thing of the week is to talk about the Klingon language. And I just love the fact that there's a whole Klingon language community out there. There's people who speak Klingon. There's the Klingon Language Institute, and that it is a growing and evolving language still to this day. And they hold events and all this kind of stuff. And Mark Ockrand is obviously the big expert in all things Klingon. He's been the linguist that's been involved with the Star Trek franchise since the 80s. He's worked on Discovery. He basically creates new words for Klingon. He did a lot for season one of Star Trek Discovery. He still works with them on other languages as well. But he also takes requests, which is kind of cool, from the community.
Is there a form we can fill out?
I believe there is. In the last week, he's created some new words to fit with the pandemic era. So you could now say COVID-19, coronavirus, and vaccination. There are now official Klingon words for all of these and phrases. I'm not even going to try to pronounce them in Klingon.
Do one.
No. Okay. No.
Next time,
I really can't.
Next time Mary Chifo's on, we'll have her do it.
Yeah, there's a good idea. But we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And it's just, you know, Klingon lives on. What's your link for the week?
So mine is a random fact. So I do a lot of the posts for Trek Movie that are birthdays of people who are involved in the show. I make most of those. And so as I'm always researching these things and just looking up, seeing where I can get. And of course, we all know there have been lots of families and siblings and people on Star Trek. But I found one trio of guest stars that it's three generations of women from one family. Next generation into Star Trek Picard. So it's kind of funny. Herta Ware was in Next Generation season one as Jean-Luc Picard's mom in Where No One Has Gone Before. There was the hallucinations and he thought he saw his mom in the corridor or something. Right? I think that's where it was.
I remember.
Maman, he called her. Then her daughter, Ellen Geer, was in season five in Silicon Avatar. She was Dr. Kyla Marr, and she's the one who went kind of crazy after researching the crystalline entity and kept asking Data to read these logs in the voice of her son. And then her daughter, Willow, was a random refugee in Absolute Candor, Star Trek Picard season one. And I'm wondering if, I'm sure he had no idea that he was doing a scene with someone in the background whose grandmother had played his mom. Which is so funny to think about. And then there's, if anyone really remembers old TV, Will Geer from the Waltons is the father of Ellen and Willow. He was married to Herta Ware. But that's so like a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter, all guest actors on Star Trek.
Wow. I think there's a lot of brother, sister, father, you know, child, but you found it perhaps the only three generation Star Trek connection
so far. So if you know of any others, please let us know. But that's the only one I've found so far. And I was fascinated. Yeah. These rabbit holes I could go into. I mean, thank you, Memory Alpha, because I could just sit on that site all day clicking from one thing to the next. It will lead you on a journey and your day will disappear before you know it.
Such a great site. So thank you again for listening to All Access Star Trek.
That's it for this episode of All Access Star Trek. Please come to the site. You can read all the stories that we've been talking about and get more details. You can tell us what you think about all of those stories, everything we've been talking about, the podcast in general, your Star Trek thoughts, whatever you like.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.